Good morning, and welcome to First Coast Connect. I'm Ann Schindler. Before we get rolling, here are three things you should know today. First, Trevor Lawrence celebrated the Jags' victory this weekend by having Waffle House cater breakfast for the team's front office. Lawrence memorably celebrated the team's January comeback against the LA Chargers at the Jacksonville Beach location. Second, police now say the man who shot and killed two women in San Marco in August followed one of them from the downtown bar where she worked. News for Jax reports the man legally purchased the gun used in the murders despite a history of substance abuse and a previous commitment to a mental health facility. Finally, the Georgia Trust for Historic Preservation recently named Sapelo Island one of its 2024 places in peril. The trust says the historic island, part of the National Gullah Geechee Corridor, faces an existential threat from development. As it happens, the past and future of the Gullah Geechee community is the topic of our conversation today. Two experts join me to discuss an upcoming cultural celebration. Plus, a local bankruptcy judge works to stem the flow of veterans in financial crisis. And later, we're joined in studio by Jacksonville Renaissance artist Jennifer Chase. But first, thousands of acres of coastline and sea islands stretching between North Carolina and Florida are home to the Gullah Geechee Nation. I'm joined by two people who can trace their lineage to the Gullah Geechee ancestors and are working to preserve the culture. Documentary filmmaker Derek Hankerson helps produce an annual festival celebrating the community's history and traces his lineage to the Gullah Geechee people. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Sondra Marine, president of the Jacksonville Gullah Geechee Nation Community Development Corporation and also a descendant of this historic community. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
To our listeners, what do you know about the Gullah Geechee people? Were you ever taught about this historic community's roots in Florida and Georgia? Give us a call at 549-2937. Tag us on X at FCC On Air or send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also message us on the First Coast Connect Facebook and Instagram pages. Sondra Marine, begin by telling those who may not know a brief history of the Gullah Geechee people. Who are they?
Gullah Geechee people are descendants from West and Central Africa. They're also descendants from individuals who were on this land prior to colonization. The Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Corridor spans from North Carolina, the Cape Fear River, to St. Augustine, Florida, the St. John's River. It is 12,315 square miles of endangered cultural heritage for those who were enslaved and isolated on some 80 barrier islands, which extend into the Atlantic Ocean. This is home to approximately 5 million people. Jacksonville, as we know it, is a home of the largest population of Gullah Geechee descendants.
Okay. And the history of those people, those enslaved people, came primarily from West Africa, is that correct?
The literature suggests that they primarily came from West and Central.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the population were originally working on plantations, rice and indigo, is that correct, kind of in that area?
So when we began to speak of Gullah Geechee people, we are generally infusing the language of Gullah Geechee, which is a newly designated Gullah/Geechee is newly designated by the United States government to interpret the life and history of a group of people who were enslaved and who lived within the boundaries of that 30-mile inland and who still hold most of the Afrocentric cultural heritage traits that's in cooking, language, and in actions. Basically, when you speak of Gullah Geechee people, you always think of them as being in the quarter, but Gullah Geechee people are actually global. They are all over the United States because of enslavement and emancipation. They moved, and with them, the culture moved. we're primarily today giving information about the individuals that are still domiciled within that 30-mile inland stretch.
Derek Hankerson, a little later we're going to talk about an upcoming festival in Armstrong, which is inland St. Johns County, kind of near Elkton. But start by telling us your family's connection to Armstrong and the Gullah Geechee community.
My paternal grandmother was West African. My maternal great-great-grandfather was West African. His profession was farming. His profession was farming because West and Central Africans were experts with reference to agriculture, horticulture, silviculture, husbandry, and hence why the millions of West and Central Africans who were imported to the New World to help settle the New World because of their expertise. We were talking earlier in your promo about the Jacksonville Jags. For any professional team who is looking to make it to the championship, you do not recruit your weakest players. You recruit your best players. Those best players who were West Africans, as Sandra was explaining, helped settle the Sea Islands. They formed some of the first militias in the territory of La Frarira, which is now a state, and it dates back to 1513. With reference to the specific question, after the Civil War, General William Tecumseh Sherman issued Order Number 15. Order Number 15 confiscated 400,000 acres of Confederate land, 30 miles inland, and it started in the Carolinas, and it came down the St. Johns County River and ended in what is now St. Johns County. President Abraham Lincoln signed Order Number 15 in the field, in the military field, 4 days later. That policy lasted a year, and what it did was it allowed for those newly freed slaves to acquire 40 acres and a mule. Two communities in the exceptional county of St. John's, which was one of the first counties established in Florida, the other is Escambia, was established July 1st, 1821. The two areas that were created after the Civil War were Lincolnville, which was originally named it was originally named West Africa. It was settled in 1866. Armstrong was settled in 1889. Those two communities were settled by my relatives. More specifically, Armstrong was settled by my grandmother's people, great-grandmother, and so on and so forth. And hence, we were able to connect the Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Corridor to St. Johns County through a management plan because the United States Department of Interior left out St. Augustine and St. Johns County. When those newly freed slaves were looking for freedom, they would not have stopped in Cowford. That was the name of Jacksonville prior to Andrew Jackson. They would have come to the Spanish capital, which is St. Augustine, and they acquired their freedom. The policy only lasted a year because President Abraham Lincoln was shot and killed. His vice president, Andrew Jackson, was a segregationist. He acquired the 400,000 acres back. So the only people who were able to benefit from that policy over a year was the exceptional community of St. John's, Armstrong, and Lincolnville.
And so, Sandra, this corridor, you said it's a 12,000-mile. It stretches from, I believe, Pender, North Carolina, down into St. Johns County, about 35 miles inland. It was designated by an act of Congress in 2006.
Yes.
And so preserving this area is a large task. It's a large area. In a recent interview with NBC, Akua Page, who's a Gullah Geechee tour guide in Charleston, South Carolina, talked about one particular aspect of preserving Gullah Geechee culture, and that was the language. Let's hear a little bit about what she had to say, and then I'd like to talk to you about that.
If I was to greet y'all in Gullah, I would say, how hana fadu or how yena fadu. But if I was to greet you in Geechee, I'd just be like, what's going on? I feel like it's our duty to tell our ancestors' story. You know, going back to that African proverb, you know, until the lion tells their terror, the story of the hunt is always going to glorify the hunter. So I feel like, you know, I'm that lioness. You know, I'm going to tell the story of my ancestors.
Sandra, talk about the language, the Gullah language, the Geechee language, and how it's distinct.
Well, I can tell you, I spoke Gullah until I was about six. I had to be taught to speak English because my grandmother, who was my caregiver, gave me all of my lessons of words in Gullah. So I called every animal a Gullah name, and when it was time for me to go to school, my sister, who was in speech, had to reprogram my tongue in order to speak English. So there is a story that moves with the cultural components of the man. That is, as they move through the land. After emancipation, many people moved to areas where there were work. And a lot of South Carolinians moved to Jacksonville because we had work in Jacksonville. The train system, you know, steel mill, employment. There were quarters all around where railroads were being
made. And where were you raised?
I was raised 1407 Franklin Street, right in front of Matthew Gilbert. But my grandmother lived right across the tracks on Phillips and Emerson, which that community is still there. So that community was established by USCT, the colored troops who got out of the Civil War and began to establish that Emerson Pine Forest community. So getting back to your question about the language, it is not necessarily location. It moves with the individual, and there are different components of the language that definitely move. So it's integrated, and as we learn more about the Gullah Geechee, which is that new designation, we're able to then interpret some of the movement of people. That in total diaspora, the language, the Afro-Creole language, the Afro-Seminole language, all of those languages are placed in a melting pot. And when you come out with what you hear, there's going to be some distinctive characteristics. I just took a trip across country, and I paid close attention to the language. We had people in Louisiana who sound like they were from Georgia. So basically, as the enslaved moved on plantations, that language still stayed with those who were isolated, and then it moved. So after emancipation, during the time of Reconstruction, there was a big melting of culture. Because we were no longer in someone else's kitchen, we were in our own. So we were in our own confines with family, and we established, and the culture had the language evolve, which means Jacksonville today may not speak the same language as South Carolinians. We can understand it because most of us have heard it. We've grown up around it.
And that recording we played is familiar to you?
Oh, yeah. I could understand it. I could understand everything. So most people who heard it, I'm sure Derek can understand it as well. And it's an amazing feat to just see and hear how the language itself shows the culture and just exactly how it moved.
So preserving the language of this culture is one challenge. And it's not just about language, though. There's other elements of the culture that are at risk, and land is a big part of that.
Huge part.
So I want to just brief our listeners. So we're talking about 8 million acres of land, and a lot of that land has become resort developments. Jekyll Island,
yes.
St. Simon's Island,
yes.
Cumberland. Hilton Head is perhaps one of the most famous,
yes,
resort islands that used to be Gullah Geechee land.
Yes.
Talk to me about the challenges that land itself presents, and then I want to play a little sound from an interview in a moment with an attorney that's working to preserve the land.
I'll do this briefly and quickly. A lot of, if not all of the land was aired property Unfortunately, there were not a lot of titles on that land. There was not a lot of taxes paid on that land. And if you have no title and no taxes, you can find attorneys who are savvy enough to work around the legal system to acquire what it is they want to acquire. And that is literally what has and is happening.
Let's hear a little sound from him and then we'll circle back. This is Gullah attorney Willie Hayward talking about his efforts to preserve the land.
When the ancestors acquired it, this was not a very desirable place to live because of the lack of air conditioning, mosquitoes, alligators, and lack of access, lack of bridges and so on and so forth, and roads. But now that it's changed, so that progress, for lack of a better word, has brought in folks who now want to divest Gullah Geechee people of that land for development purposes.
So some of that land is now really some of the most valuable property in the states that are part of that corridor.
It is the most valuable land. Let's think back to the, as Sandra was saying, let's think back to the 18th and 19th century. With water comes what? Mosquitoes. So no one would want to live near a mosquito-infested area. And the only people who could survive those mosquito-infested areas are West and Central African who have built up immunity to prevent them from acquiring or getting malaria and yellow fever. And hence why West and Central Africans were the staple of people who helped this exceptional nation become what it is. Without the strength of these people, of us, no one would have survived. And there were slaves and indentured servants and servants and everything else prior to that time, but they died. They died because the South was nothing but a swamp. So for this exceptional experiment to have succeeded, you needed the strongest of people. Those strongest of peoples were West and Central Africans who could survive. And so they lived on the barrier islands. And now, because of the interview that you just played, people want to do what? Live on the ocean. They want to build multi-million dollar mansions on the ocean. And that was our family's former property.
Sandra, talk about that. This is a issue that the loss of that land has really impacted the ability of the Gullah Geechee people and the Gullah Geechee Nation to derive the benefits of the value of that land.
That's true. It's amazing that Gullah Geechee people can own large parcels of land for long periods of time, but they are unable to get the necessary dollars to develop those lands themselves. When the investors come in to purchase the land, they use all kinds of tactics in order to do that. And some are legal, you know, some are not. However, we have very little recourse. Sometimes the taxes go up. The individuals who are on the property are unable to pay. That heirs property portal is something that we're looking very strongly with right now. In fact, we do have an initiative right now in Jacksonville to help people maintain their land. So South Carolina and the larger deep water lands is not the only place where Gullah Geechee descendants are actually losing their economic stand. You know, in our communities right now in the city of Jacksonville, we have more rentals in our areas because of loss of property due to taxes or heirs property due to taxes or taxation on individuals who are unable to pay or economically unsound.
So the issue of preserving culture in some ways is aided by isolation. And in a recent interview, Queen Quet, who is the founder of the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition, she lives in St. Helena Island, which is about midway between Charleston and Savannah, gives you an idea of kind of the communities there, how they've developed, how wealthy and prosperous they are because, I mean, that are benefiting people that own them now. And she was asked about the isolation of the area and kind of how that contributed to the culture and also its risks to development. So let's hear a little bit of that.
We're insulated and kind of kept warmed and keep our culture alive away from the mainland culture. Folks come in with bulldozers, and the first thing we see is they want to dig up what we've already had for all these generations, and then they want to build something that's antithetical to our culture.
Talk about that, Derek. What is antithetical about development, and how is it that the kind of low-density development that has defined the Gullah Geechee Nation contributes to their heritage?
Traditionally, if you look at any farming families, mine included, you would find that they would live in very modest homes, and their land is the wealth. They would not build houses that are 5, 10, 15,000 square feet. And the opportunity to farm your own land, to grow your own food, so to reduce high blood pressure, to reduce high cholesterol. If you were feeding yourself and your family, that would fit within the confines of the culture to include, we would eat a lot of the crustacean and fish from the various different waterways, and that is what made our unique food. And without that, there is no food. There is no Southern food. There is no soul food. And food is one of many of the staples of the Gullah Geechee culture.
We have a call right now from Stanley on the north side. Good morning, Stanley, and welcome to First Coast Connect. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Stanley Scott here with the African American Economic Recovery Think Tank. I'm a native of Gullah Geechee. My father's from Edisto Island, South Carolina. First of all, Africans have been here over 15,000 years. We come from the north, and then we came down to the south. Now, number two is the seafood from the Gullah Geechee community. We didn't want to create that. Number three here, one of the reasons why the Gullah Geechee community is not moving forward because they are not organized, especially in Jacksonville, Florida. Thank you.
Thank you, Stanley.
May I address his point?
Certainly.
He's absolutely correct. The unique history of Florida dating back 500 years, because we know Florida was settled in 1513. If anyone looks at a world map, you'll see Spain is here, Africa here is here, and Portugal is over here. We have to remember that North Africans or Moors ruled Spain for 700 years, from 711 to 1492. 1492, Christopher Columbus explored, right? That opened up the age of exploration. So our families moved from the age of exploration to La Florida. Starting in 1513, Spanish brought with them free and enslaved Africans. Starting in 1513, and in fact, 1513, there were two Africans, free Africans, who were on the ship. One, Guiardo, who introduced wheat to the New World, and one, Gonzalez. In 1565, my hometown of St. Augustine was established with 800 Spanish on that ship. Between 40 and 60 free and enslaved Africans traveled. So he's absolutely correct. With reference to Florida, we have been in Florida over 500 years, and in St. Augustine for over 450 years. It's not about feelings. These are the facts.
So let's talk a little bit about the traditions that you're working to preserve. Sandra, I know that one thing that you are a part of promoting is Watch Night, also known as Freedom's Eve. Tell people what that is and when it's celebrated and why.
Watch Night is New Year's Eve. December 31st, and it is celebrated each year. This year, we will do a celebration at 12 noon Sunday, December 31st, at Mount Zion AME Church, historic Mount Zion in downtown Jacksonville. The program itself will give education to the components of emancipation, reconstruction, civil rights. I mean, we will give a full Florida history as it relates to the Native American occupation. We'll take a deep dive into the history of Jacksonville. We still have mounds here that have been archaeologically confined and taught in a lot of classrooms that are 2,500 years old. You know, we still have those mounds still standing.
Explain so there's a lot. Watch Night celebrates.
So the Watch Night celebration will come in, and it will bring in the components of that ancestral lineage that we have. It is a ceremony that is practiced every year in churches all over. And it actually has a caller. It has watchmen. It has beautiful music. The components of Watch Night brings the spiritual confines of those who are there together and those who are in the age we have now, social media, who are present, are able to take a dive into what slavery did and the components of freedom. And that is what this year's Watch Night service will bring.
And to be clear, Watch Night is a reference to the night or the nights as people were waiting to hear the news of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Right. And Watch Night actually brings to the light the reading of the Emancipation Proclamation, which took place on January 1, 1861. That is prior to the Civil War. And just everyone converged on the reading of that document. And because it was said that if they were not present, they would not be free. The document itself, we know, only was effective and held an order of writ for those states that had seceded from the Union if they had slaves. If they were within the Union and they had slaves, those slaves were not free. So we have to go back and do a lot of education on the components of Watch Night, Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Johnson, and just how things moved into Reconstruction after the Civil War was over. So Watch Night service is what we're talking about. And Watch Night service is that ceremony that brings all of this together. It's practiced each year to reinforce our call for freedom, our continual emancipation as we do it daily.
And Derek, you're also a promoter and a producer of an event in St. Augustine, an annual event. I think we're going to have the 10th coming up. Tell us what is happening in Armstrong, I believe.
Well, let me first give you the backstory, and then I will address that if I may. I'll do it quickly. In 2012, I had the pleasure of hosting the National Park Service's Network to Freedom Project. And we did that because of the fact that I convinced the Department of Interior and National Park Service that while, again, facts, not feelings, while the Underground Railroad did go north to Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Canada, it actually came south to Spanish Florida starting in about 1620. So we were able to get the National Park Service and the United States Department of Interior to realize that they left out information. After that point in time, we were able to reach out to the Florida Channel. We produced a film in 2012, which is entitled The Florida Channel Southern Route to Freedom. Immediately after that, I started working with the United States Department of Interior to correct the management plan, which came from the piece of legislation in 2006, which was sponsored by Congressman James Claiborne from South Carolina, which designated the corridor left out St. John's County. So working with Sandra and others who were upset with me because of the fact that they had to redo the management plan, but it was wrong. So the Department of Interior held public meetings. Long story short, they changed the management plan thanks to my work to include St. John's County. After that was done, we started holding festivals in Armstrong 10 years ago. We held festivals in Armstrong because Armstrong and Lincolnville was now designated as part of the Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Corridor. And so from there, we had a number of bike trails, 3 cycling trails, Sea Island Loop, Rails to Trails, and the East Coast Greenway. The East Coast Greenway is the longest cycling trail in the U.S. Calais, Maine, all the way down the Key West. Armstrong was right in the mix, and thankfully our former county commissioners in St. John's saw the vision with reference to creating these trails. We connected the trails to Armstrong. We started holding festivals 10 years ago. I was one of the grant writers. We wrote a number of different grants to St. John's County Cultural Council, St. John's County Tourist Development Council, and Visit Florida. We were awarded resources to put on the grant. That was 10 years ago. Fast forward to today, St. John's Cultural Council picked up the festival a couple of years ago, and we went from hosting 400 to 500 people to last year. We had some 4,000 people in this year, thanks to the exceptional county of St. John's, thanks to the wonderful employees that the St. John's Cultural Council and the TDC of St. John's County. We're hoping to have 10,000 people this year.
That festival is Saturday, December 2nd. It's from noon to 5 p.m. It's the 10th annual Gullah Geechee Heritage Festival.
Yes.
And it is at Armstrong Park, which is in Elkton, Florida, at 4950 Harvey Avenue. I'd like to thank my guests so much. Sandra Marine, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Derek Hankerson, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in just a moment with a judge who's throwing a financial lifeline to local veterans. Welcome back. Bankruptcy is a crisis for any family, but it happens here more than in most places. The Middle District of Florida has the third busiest bankruptcy court of the 90 districts in the nation. Jacksonville is part of the Middle District, which also includes Tampa and Orlando. I'm joined now by U.S. Bankruptcy Judge for the Middle District, Jacob Brown, who is one of the people behind an upcoming financial wellness summit for military members. Good morning, Judge. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you for having me on.
It's my pleasure. To our listeners, have you had to declare bankruptcy? And has your experience as a military member created unique financial hardships for you or your family? Give us a call at 549-2937. Tag us on X at FCC On Air or send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also message us on Facebook or Instagram. Judge Jacob Brown, the Jacksonville Bar Association and the local bankruptcy bar are sponsoring what's called a Military Financial Wellness Summit on December 9th. So before we get to the details of the event, what does it mean to file for bankruptcy?
Sure. You know, the majority of people that are seeking bankruptcy protection have fallen on hard times for various numbers of reasons. It could be a lost job. It could be a health issue. And most of them are just looking to get past their financial issues and get a fresh start. And that's what the bankruptcy law provides for the most part.
And who is eligible to file bankruptcy? What are the requirements?
Virtually any individual that has financial difficulty would be eligible to file for bankruptcy. Most businesses are eligible as well. And it, depending on what your particular issues are, it would govern kind of where, what chapter for bankruptcy you would file under.
And so is bankruptcy, filing for bankruptcy, is that considered relief or is it a recognition of a financial failing?
I wouldn't necessarily call it a failing in most instances. Most people have good intentions when they come to bankruptcy court. They've fallen on hard times, like I said, for various reasons. And they're looking for relief, like you said. They're looking for relief from the debt. And in the United States, we have a federal bankruptcy code that allows for most people facing, you know, financial issues to put those behind them and get a fresh start.
And so what is bankruptcy court like? Is it like regular court, like I think of with witnesses and testimony? Is there a jury? How does it operate?
We rarely have juries, but we are a regular federal court. In fact, it's the federal court where we see within the federal court system where most people appear. And it just depends on the nature of the case. Many cases never come before court at all. Some cases have issues over various debt or property rights. And so we'll have hearings and witnesses sometimes, and we have to make decisions and write orders.
And so what are the long-term consequences of filing for bankruptcy? And when you talk about relief, what does it actually provide for?
So the relief is generally, if you do all the right things in your bankruptcy case, which tends to be you list all your assets that you have, you list all your debts, you give people proper notice. And if you do those things and meet the other requirements under the bankruptcy code, you get what is called a discharge, which is a discharge of most of your debts. Now, not all debts are discharged. Certain tax debts, marital-related debts, child support, student loans is a big one that gets a lot of press currently. Those would survive bankruptcy, but credit card debt generally gets discharged and a lot of other debts would get discharged. So you can move forward in life and not be legally responsible for those debts after you get a discharge.
It's harder to file for bankruptcy now, though, than it used to be. Is that true?
I wouldn't say it's harder to file. Back a few years ago, Congress passed a law that said that if you have certain income level, then you have to be in a Chapter 13 and repay a portion of your debts from your income. So they made it, they just changed the law around a little bit. But it's some people could perceive that as being more difficult, but most individuals can still file for bankruptcy.
So talk about your docket load. Like, how many cases do you handle? How many cases does the Middle District of Florida handle? And how does it compare?
Sure. Like you said earlier, we are one of the busiest courts in the United States, and we tend to average per judge in the Middle District somewhere between 1,800 to 3,000 cases, give or take. It depends on certain times of year and sometimes financial incidents that would cause a wave of filings. And we handle those cases. We have a really, really good system for how we process cases in the Middle District with a really strong clerk's office and great support for the judges to be able to handle that kind of workload of cases. Historically, in the past.
Are those numbers you're talking about per judge? I kind of missed.
Yes, per judge.
So as many as 3,000 cases before one judge?
Yes. And some of those can be very, very active cases, and some of those we really don't see that much. So
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you though. Continue what you were going to say.
Oh no, I mean, historically there had been times where there would be, you know, nationwide financial incidents and judges would handle 4,000 or 5,000 cases at a time. They've been really busy. So would the bankruptcy lawyers.
And so how does the Middle District compare to other districts? You say it's many more, and is there a sense as to why that is?
I think we have a pretty high population in the Middle District compared to some of the smaller areas. I mean, I've heard, and I don't know for sure, but there's some districts that, let's take South Dakota, for example. I think that the judges in South Dakota may have less than 1,000 cases per judge. So
So let's talk about this upcoming summit. It's your brainchild. Why did you conceive of the idea to have a financial, you know, health summit for the military in particular?
So not exactly my brainchild. I have to give credit to the Florida Bar Business Law Section and specifically Judge Laurel Isikoff in Miami. She held one of these events back in 2020, a much smaller scale than what we're doing. And then the business law section said that went really well. Let's try to expand it to the other cities in Florida where we have a large military presence. And so that's kind of how we got started on this particular summit that's going to happen on December 9th.
And why focus on the military? What are the special challenges that service members face?
Sure. One, we want to give back for all that they have done for the country and recognize that. Two, the various problems that veterans and military face include financial issues, and we want to be able to provide a support network for them, help them out as best that we can. There are a lot of programs for people in financial distress throughout the Middle District and other areas, but we've decided to focus on military and veterans for various reasons.
And do they have special challenges that this summit is designed to address?
Yes, both in the culture of the military, in providing them, you know, support that they may not be able to get from other places. And this summit is bringing together resources from lots of different areas, and I'm glad to go over that in a minute if you'd like, to provide them with information. They're going to be able to meet with lawyers one-on-one. They'll be able to meet with a financial advisor one-on-one. And not just targeting military and veterans that have financial problems. Certainly that is a focus. But also if there's somebody there that wanted to meet with a lawyer or financial advisor to talk about buying a house or starting a business, there are those resources there as well.
So this is designed to be really kind of a one-on-one assistance.
We're going to have a short program. Very excited that your predecessor, Melissa Ross, is going to MC the event.
Oh, cool.
So we'll have a short program at the beginning with a number of people in the community that are sponsors or providing support. And that'll go for maybe 45 minutes. And then we're going to have tables set up with our various community partners that are participating. And then I don't know the exact number of lawyers and financial advisors, but we're hoping to have somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 volunteer lawyers and financial advisors there to meet one-on-one with any active military or veteran that wants to talk about whatever their particular issue may be.
And just very briefly, how can people register or get involved?
Sure. So there is a website that you're going to ask me to repeat three times. So let me go slowly. It's JAX Military Financial Summit.com. That's JAX Military Financial Summit.com. And you can go there and register. With the great support that we're getting from ViStar Federal Credit Union and the city of Jacksonville, we're going to be able to offer a free meal. I think
We may have to leave it there. U.S. Bankruptcy Judge Jacob Brown, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stick around. We'll be right back with playwright and performer Jennifer Chase.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you. Vickers Landing's newest senior living community is Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, featuring a resort lifestyle and a plan for every stage of aging. Vickers Landing is nestled in the heart of Ponte Vedra Beach. For information, vickerslanding.com.
Teach is a day-long conference created to engage, empower, and inspire teachers.
I have been so inspired inspired by all the teachers and future teachers that we have at this conference, the Teach Conference in Jacksonville 2023. And it has been a positive day that has just really re-inspired me and got me really excited to go back into the classroom.
Early bird tickets are available for $40. For tickets and more info, go to wjct.org/teach.
On the next Fresh Air, award-winning playwright Larissa Fasthorse talks about her satirical comedy, The Thanksgiving Play, and bringing Native American voices to the theater. The Thanksgiving Play was one of the most produced plays in America, and this year Fasthorse became the first Native American woman known to have a play produced on Broadway. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
By the numbers, Chinese food has never been more popular. You can now expect to find one Chinese restaurant in at least 70% of all U.S. counties. And the tastes available are every bit as diverse as the country it comes from. Next time on 1A, we explore Chinese culinary culture, its mythical and historical past, and why it's now a firm American favorite.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Playwright and musician Jennifer Chase has been a pivotal figure in Jacksonville's art and music scene for over three decades. In 2022, she was the recipient of the Art Ventures Grant from the Community Foundation of Northeast Florida. She joins us today to preview her upcoming retrospective performance. Jennifer Chase, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much, Anne, for having me.
It's our pleasure. So for our listeners who may not be familiar with your work, what are some of the themes and elements that you've used in your work over the past few decades?
Yeah, interestingly enough, it's home and people. And those are sometimes synonymous for me, the people of Jacksonville, and this idea of us struggling to come up with where is home. I've taught refugees for many, many years in Jacksonville, uncovered historical figures like Anta Mijigan Jai or Anna Kingsley, and written plays and songs about her in Senegal. Mavin Bech, an amazing. So there's just no limit to the richness of the collaborative partners I have in the artist communities, my students and mentors, and history. And it all overlaps, and of course, family. And it all is the same thing for me and gives rise to my productions, ranging from rock operas to musicals to solo performances.
You've really done so much. You describe your work as character driven. So what is your process for bringing these characters to life?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because thanks to the Community Foundation for this grant and writing this project, which is about process. And so I had to deconstruct to reconstruct. So first, I'm inspired by a person and a feeling. A lot of times I connect on a personal level with the person, which doesn't find its way into the play directly at all. Qualitative research is a really important part of my process. And so it takes as long as it takes, which can mean travel, it can mean reading, it can mean lots of interviews, connecting past and present. So a lot of it's lonely at first, but then very early on, I bring in music and collaborative partners. And so lyrics and metaphors have an important role in what I do.
So your upcoming performance is kind of a mix of memoir and yeah, theater and songwriting. Tell us about the project. What is it? And how does it, what are we going to see?
Yeah. So it's called I Can Smell You From Here. We're allowed to say that, right?
You can say
okay.
that.
I can smell
Hopefully
you.
Hopefully you can't smell me from here.
But. No. And it's 17 letters to my city. So beginning in 1993, and I don't think this is helpful to our listeners, but it might be helpful to you. 1993, that little girl on my very first album, I had never written a song when I moved here, is the little girl on the cover of my book and my new album.
And you should know it's a picture of a darling little girl dressed up in a frilly dress and a kind of a veil, and it says Kid Jail.
That was the name of my first album. Yeah. So when I wrote the grant, and I thought I'm going to dare myself to do this project in which I go back 30 years and examine the richness of the people along the way who have been a part of this system of developing as an artist, finding my home, uncovering people's stories that don't think there's anything special about them, or we might not, or history might not have decided they were special. And so the project is 17 letters to Jacksonville, in which Jacksonville is the you in the story. And what I thought was going to be a critique, really, of my city, turned out to be a mixed bag of incredible appreciation. And calling up people that I started this musical journey with 30 years ago and sitting at my kitchen table in my fabulous newly renovated kitchen in my 82-year-old house and having conversations and rediscovering the exhale and the ease with which we artists in Jacksonville communicate. It's so invigorating in a climate that's brutal right now for so many. It feels frivolous to me in a way to talk about 30 years of artistic work, yada yada, my albums, my plays, unless I can find a contribution that I can make to own failure, which is a big part of why I asked the Community Foundation for an extension and they gave it to me. It took a while to address not only Jacksonville's failures along the way, but my own and where we take that from here artistically. And so my fellow artists were a big part of that exhale of understanding each other.
It's terrible how fast this goes by, but the performance of I Can Smell You From Here, it's November 29th at Babs Lab. Just very briefly, where can people get tickets?
Okay, so people can get tickets at jenchase.com. There's a link at Babs Lab where you can purchase your tickets. We're almost sold out, I think. I'm going to have a cellist, Holly D. Cardenas, and pianist Michelle Battaglia, and she's going to be performing the music from my 7-song EP, and I will be performing excerpted scenes directed by the one and only fabulous Barbara Colicello.
All right, we've got a song that you shared with us here. It's called Houston and Lee. Jennifer Chase, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Anne.
That's our program. Join us again on Wednesday when we explore the history of St. Augustine's first Thanksgiving. I'm Anne Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.